Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got co-host Dr. Carl Nadolski, Jr., super endocrinologist, and we got an awesome guest today. And of course, I always say every guest is awesome, but she is quite spectacular. She had a really cool study that just came out that we were really interested in. Dr. Rebecca Pearl, assistant professor in the Department of Clinical and Health Psychology at the College of Public Health and Health Professions at University of Florida. So welcome, Dr. Pearl.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I should also say you also run the body. Do you run the Body Image and Stigma lab there? Is that,
yes.
Is that your,
that's so
that
cool.
That is my lab. Yeah. Thank you.
That's amazing. And then one thing is, so Dr. Spencer called it the Gator Clap, which we're pretty sure that's not correct for all the University of Florida Gators out there. So Spencer just embarrassed everybody, or embarrassed himself mostly. So,
Just embarrassed me because nobody needed to know that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's how that works. So, anyways, let's have Dr. Pearl do the Gator Chomp.
Oh, time. Yeah, we want to see the Gator Chomp
in case anybody's watching the YouTube.
Well, and I should know which arm is supposed to be on top, but it is a full Gator Chomp.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. According to the Gator that I see online when I look this up, the mascot, he does have his right arm up, so that looks correct. All right, so we're good for all the Gators out there.
I like a Gator clap, but whatever. Okay, the reason we had you on this, we contacted you right away when the study got published. It was a really, like, we're going to go into your background and stuff, but the reason we contacted you in the first place is because we've talked about stigma and bias on this podcast. My brother, Dr. Carl, just... you were the first author on the mm-hmm. ACE stigma guidelines.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is hugely important. And obviously, I'm a clinical endocrinologist and obesity specialist. So, you know, I'm seeing patients with obesity complicated by severe complications of obesity. And that's how, you know, we stage the severity of disease. And I'm not a psychologist, but I was asked.
You sure as hell aren't.
I was asked to drive that because of, you know, more of the expertise in diagnosis and staging the severity of disease, and the better awareness, or at least trying to increase the awareness of this weight bias and stigma. And so we got this huge consensus panel of different people that went there. Boy, now in hindsight, I wish we somehow would have had you at the consensus panel a year ago that led to a lot of discussion, a lot of representatives from different professional organizations, ranging from the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association to all the different obesity organizations, et cetera. And we did have some psychologists there, including Spencer Jason Helford, who is the president of the European Association for the Study of Obesity. He's a psychologist. Anyways, the bottom line of it was we have to keep finding ways to clinically diagnose and include internalized weight bias and stigma in our evaluation and treatment of patients with obesity, while also, you know, obviously acknowledging the external biases, from clinicians and the public, et cetera. And one of our main real conclusions of this is that, especially for patients, their internalized weight bias really drives poor outcomes, just in general. It's like this huge vicious cycle. It causes problems with our healthcare
Well, why don't you let Dr. Pearl say it? I'm
telling her why we want her on here. Because the point is, what do we do about it? Shut up.
I want Dr. Pearl to say it because they should have had her on the paper, not you.
Yeah. Well, that's not wrong.
No. And it's so fantastic to hear that, you know, all these organizations are starting to recognize weight bias and stigma as a really pivotal piece of the puzzle in addressing weight and obesity. And you don't have to be a psychologist to recognize it, right? If you just live in this world, you've been exposed to these negative messages. So it's so salient and prevalent that you don't have to, you know, study it to be aware of it and to know that it's harmful. And I do want to just make a point of saying that when we think about internalized weight stigma, we want to be careful not to pathologize it. So I think, like, I wouldn't necessarily say we want to diagnose it, but more just kind of have awareness of it and screen for it, because stigma is so pervasive in our society. It's only natural for some people to internalize it to this strong degree. So we want to be careful of not kind of framing it as something wrong with patients who have these high levels of internalized stigma, but more, you know, an expected outcome of living in our society and the messages we receive. And for people who have internalized it to a higher degree, such that it is really negatively impacting their psychological and physical well-being, we want to be able to screen for that so we can provide additional support.
Yeah. So that's a great point. And could you give a good description from your perspective on, you know, the definition, I guess, or at least what people, so people can understand what the heck it is we're even talking about.
What is internalized?
Yeah. Yes. Great question. And there are some different definitions, but in research, we typically define this as the process when someone is first aware of kind of the negative bias and stigma against their group, in this case, folks with a higher weight, and start to buy into the negative stereotypes and messages that they're exposed to. So with weight, some of the most common stereotypes are that people are lazy, that they lack willpower, that they're less intelligent, or, you know, just less worthy as people. So when people with a high weight start to believe that those stereotypes are true and apply them to themselves, that's where we see this kind of internalization, or also sometimes called self-stigma. So people are applying those negative beliefs and attitudes toward themselves, and as a result, having lower self-worth or self-esteem because of their weight.
Yeah.
And then, so then what happened? Like, does it, and you said not to pathologize it, but like, what occurs then? Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy, or what else happens?
Yep. So there's a lot of research on some of the psychological and behavioral and physical health consequences of internalizing weight stigma. So we know people with higher levels of internalized stigma have lower self-esteem, more symptoms of depression and anxiety. So that's where that internalization, which again is kind of, you know, not unexpected in the society we live in, but for some people, there's a higher level of internalization that then can then maybe translate into clinical symptoms of depression and anxiety. We also know it's associated with poor body image and disordered eating behaviors, which again makes sense at face value, right? If someone hates their body and hates themselves, they're going to be more susceptible to engaging in extreme behaviors to try to control their weight that we know are really harmful and damaging. And there's also research that by my group and others showing that when people have higher levels of internalized stigma, they also have less self-efficacy or less confidence to engage in health-promoting behaviors like physical activity and healthy eating. And that's where some of the work that I and others have done, including this recent study, is also looking at its impact on weight management. There remains kind of a common misperception in our society and even among some healthcare providers that stigma might motivate people to lose weight or to engage in health promoting behaviors. But time and time again, we find the opposite, that when people have these negative attitudes and beliefs about themselves because of their weight, it actually undermines their ability and their confidence to engage in health promoting behaviors.
Yeah, that was a significant point that we found in our, you know, literature review and putting that paper together, is that that's kind of that vicious cycle I mentioned. It was driving the exact opposite of what we want to help people do, ultimately with the end goal of improving their health, you know, literally their physical, but also their mental health. And that's really our goal for everybody.
Absolutely. And another, you know, point too, that is especially relevant in medical care, are the stressors that are related to stigma. So experiencing stigma from other people is stressful, right? You can imagine having an exchange where someone is criticizing you because of your weight, or just walking into a room and worrying about how other people are thinking about you or how other people will treat you because of your weight. That's stressful. And there's some emerging research that the internalization of stigma may have similar kinds of effects related to stress. So someone who's just constantly derogating themselves or criticizing themselves because of their weight, that there may be a chronic stress response that happens in the body too, in response to those kind of negative feelings and negative thoughts that people are constantly being bombarded with and applying to themselves. So this is kind of a newer area of research with internalized stigma, but we've known for a while that experiencing stigma more generally is a form of stress that also undermines health and can contribute to increased risk for chronic diseases.
Yeah, it's not just psychological. It could turn to physiological or pathophysiological, I should say. What you're describing, and there are studies that show that those who have the most internalization, do they tend to do worse when it comes to outcomes when doing weight loss attempts or comprehensive weight loss programs? Is that true?
Yeah. So there's a little bit of research on this. I would put a plug in for researchers and clinicians who deliver these kinds of treatments to start measuring stigma in their research or in their clinical practice, because we don't have a lot of information about how stigma changes with treatment or how stigma may predict these treatment outcomes. But some of the work that my team and others have done have suggested some evidence that there's less long-term weight loss and maintenance among folks who have higher levels of internalized stigma. But I will say there's only a few studies on this, and some of the findings are mixed. So some studies show that maybe that's true for some demographic groups, but not all demographic groups. So there's definitely room for a lot more research on this.
Very cool.
But like you said before, the self-management, some of the behaviors are pretty definitively reduced. You know, the nutrition efforts, the exercise, physical activity, and even if I'm not mistaken, the medication adherence, like just the whole package. And that, so, you know, you can obviously sort of see where that would ultimately lead.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure.
So, okay. So that leads us to your study.
Because yeah, the question is, all right, so now what do we do about it?
Yes. And that is a big question of what do we do about stigma? And I'll also say that, you know, the study that we recently conducted is focused on trying to reduce internalized stigma at kind of the individual level through group counseling. This is just one level at which we need to be intervening with stigma. And ideally, we would be preventing people from internalizing this to begin with. So we need kind of big structural changes, things like policies that protect against weight discrimination, changing how people think in the public about weight, how we talk about weight, and preventing those kind of interpersonal experiences of discrimination or mistreatment due to weight. So there are other folks working at those levels. And I do just want to emphasize that, you know, the intervention that I'll talk about is just kind of one small piece of the bigger puzzle in if we're going to eradicate stigma. But the study that my team recently conducted was testing a psychological intervention to try to reduce internalized stigma in a group format among people with obesity who had high levels of internalized stigma and who had all reported experiencing some form of weight discrimination or teasing or unfair treatment. And we tested this intervention in the context of behavioral weight management. And we did that for a few reasons. One is that folks who seek weight loss treatment may have more distress about their weight, which may also mean that they are tending to be people with higher levels of internalization. So this really might be our target population who may most benefit from a stigma intervention. But also to move toward thinking about stigma as part of standard care, of something that needs to be screened and addressed for people who do report distress and need additional support. So we had done some pilot work of testing this intervention as a standalone intervention, and then did a short-term randomized control trial of either combining it with behavioral weight loss treatment or just having standard behavioral weight loss treatment alone. And then this recent study was looking at the long-term effects of combining the stigma intervention with behavioral weight management compared to standard weight management care on its own.
Very cool. Okay. So how did you intervene? Well, like, cause this is pretty novel, right?
Yeah. And you used, I think maybe one or both of the commonly used screening tools, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes.
And those are, we recommend those in the paper. But yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on those first, on how to, talk to people about this, screen it, or even for people out there thinking, well, geez, am I struggling with this? And then, then we got to figure out what the heck you're doing to intervene and make some progress.
Yeah. So the measures that we included in this study and that are kind of the main measures out there right now are the weight bias internalization scale. There's the original version. There's also a modified version that's weight neutral for folks who might be working with people with different body sizes. Because we know people of all sizes can internalize weight stigma, even though stigma does most affect people with higher weight. And then also the weight self-stigma questionnaire. So these are the two most widely used and validated measures of internalized weight stigma. There, has been some work recently to kind of look more closely at these measures. And I think there's probably room for improvement, as with anything. And in particular, paying attention to how these measures hold up in diverse samples, because a lot of these measures were initially developed primarily with white female demographics. And so making sure we can, make sure that we're testing these across diverse groups to make sure that we're really capturing what internalized stigma is across groups, where it might differ in how people talk about or think about this internalization. But as of now, these are really kind of the leading measures that are typically used. And then as far as the intervention, so I'm a clinical psychologist, and so I really drew from evidence-based strategies in cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance-based therapies, including dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, and acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, and taking some of those already evidence-based strategies, but tailoring them specifically to change how people think and feel about their weight. And so I can talk more specifically about some of the, examples of strategies.
Yeah, I'd love to know, because I have no idea.
Yeah. So we, would start the program with things of like just education about weight and weight bias, to get everyone on the same page, including, what are the causes of obesity, and try to dispel some of the myths about weight and weight loss. So some of it was education, just to learn more and get past some of these myths and stereotypes. And then we engaged with the group in challenging some of the specific stereotypes that people might apply to themselves about their weight. So a common thing that I hear from patients is that they feel like a failure because they haven't been able to control their weight or they haven't been able to lose weight. So breaking that down as a group and thinking like, okay, well, what's the evidence that you're a failure? Like, what evidence do you have to support that? And what's all the evidence that pushes back against that, that you're not actually a failure? And that might include, all the reasons we know that weight is so challenging to prevent weight gain to begin with, but also to lose. And all the other aspects of that person that make them not a failure, right? Their job, their relationships, their characteristics beyond just weight alone. And we do utilize the group format in particular because with stigma, we know that it's very common for people to feel isolated or alone. And by bringing people together who have those shared experiences, that can be really powerful. And also there are things that are just going to be more meaningful coming from other group members who are going through the same thing than an interventionist who might not have that shared experience. So the peer support being embedded in the program we found to be really critical, and comments from participants in the studies really emphasized that the peer support was a big part of it. And then, you know, in addition to kind of engaging with stereotypes, we would move more into the exact kinds of thoughts that patients had about themselves related to their weight, how that might connect to their health behaviors, as well as other behaviors in their life, like isolating themselves socially, and how that affects their emotions as well. And with the idea of trying to change some of their negative thoughts that might be biased toward the negative, right? Like thinking they're a failure, blaming themselves. And if we change those to be more accurate and more, you know, actually in line with reality, and not so heavily skewed toward the negative, that could change how they feel and could also affect their health behaviors. We did also include content that was about how to respond to other people when people have an experience of weight stigma, because that's often not talked about. Of, okay, if someone makes a comment to you about your weight, what do you say? What do you do? So we talked about different strategies of, you know, how to both cope with that experience and what they might do or say in response, how to ask a loved one to stop making comments about their weight. So those kinds of strategies were embedded as well.
Can you give a little example? I know that it takes a lot longer than what we have, but just a little example for people out there, because my God, this is so pervasive. I mean, I'm sure Spencer and I both, every day we have these patients say the same exact stuff you're saying, and we try our best on an individual basis. But these self-coping strategies, because Spencer, do you often hear that it's their family members often that
are family's the worst.
Oh my God. And it's just heartbreaking. So if you have a couple tips or pearls for people from Dr. Pearl.
Yeah. Well, you know, with family is so tough, right? And also in this intervention, you know, we make very clear there's no right or wrong way to respond. And everything's going to depend on the relationship with the person, what that relationship is like. So we talk about like different goals that someone might have in a conversation with a family member, for example. So maybe a goal is to get them to stop doing that behavior, to stop making comments about their weight. Maybe a goal is to build a more positive relationship with that person or to maintain the relationship with that person. Or a goal might be simply to be able to walk away with greater self-respect. And depending on which of those goals is the primary goal, people might adjust how they talk about this issue. Ideally, you could walk away with all three, but that might not always be the case. But we actually in the groups would, as you know, in pairs and on one's own, think about actually writing a script of how you would approach a conversation that might include things like first just laying out the facts, right? Like, every time I come over for dinner, you make some kind of negative remark about my weight and kind of getting on the same page about what's happening and what it is that's bothering the patient, talking about how that affects them, you know, that makes me feel ashamed or that makes me feel sad, makes me want to not come over for dinner anymore. And then having a very clear ask to ask the person to do something different. And then trying to reinforce that as well of, you know, if you stop making these comments about my weight, I think it'll help our relationship. I'll want to see you more often. And this largely draws from a framework from dialectical behavior therapy and interpersonal effectiveness skills. So again, it's really using what we already know to be effective, but tailoring it specifically to these kinds of challenging conversations about weight.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay. So going to the methods of your study, you had how many people in there? 105, is that right?
Yep. So this trial had 105 who were randomly assigned to one of two groups. So we had just over 50 participants who either received the stigma intervention with standard behavioral weight loss or received the weight loss treatment on its own. And it was a long-term study, so everybody was offered 20 weeks of weekly group sessions, regardless of which intervention they were in. And then we had a year-long follow-up. So they got monthly sessions for the first 6 months of that year, and then every other month sessions for the second half of that year. And in part, this is in line with, you know, guidelines for maintenance treatment. The last 6 months, we really spaced out because we wanted to do our best to see what are the long-term effects after the most active, part of the treatment. So in total, people were in treatment for 72 weeks or about a year and a half or so. But really that last year was trying to see how did that initial intensive intervention sustain, effects over time.
Do you mind me asking, when they did the power calculations, what amount of weight loss difference was it powered to detect?
Yes. So when we powered this, we were maybe a little bit ambitious in expecting a 4% weight loss difference between the two groups. We did not end up finding that. In the end, at that final week 72 endpoint, we found about a 2% weight loss difference between the two groups. So the participants who did receive the stigma intervention lost an average of 7.2% weight loss at week 72. Compared to 5.2% weight loss in the comparison group. So that was not statistically significant. I will say 5 to 7% is clinically meaningful. So both groups achieved, clinically meaningful weight losses that we know are associated with improvements in, cardiovascular and metabolic health outcomes. But the sample was probably a little small to get that big of effect.
My statistician friends would be very I'm glad you said statistically, not because my statistician friends would be like, hey, I wouldn't, don't say there's not a difference, because there, those confidence intervals, I don't know, whatever. It looks like if you had it more, like if you had 200 people, 150 people, I don't know what it'd be. They'd be like, okay, there's a difference here.
Well, and I mean, it's certainly nice to see, I think, for us, because clinically, like you just mentioned, that little bit could be very, very meaningful for patients. And then in addition to the more obvious benefits that they really achieved.
Okay, right. Because your primary outcome was difference in weight. Okay. And then there were some secondary outcomes, it looks like physical activity. What about the actual differences in how much internalization,
Yeah. So on one of the measures of internalized stigma, we did see some differences on the weight self-stigma questionnaire at certain time points. There were some small differences between the two groups. We did not see significant differences on the weight bias internalization scale. That might be in part because we screened people primarily on the weight bias internalization scale and only included people above a certain cutoff on that scale. And so because we had that restricted range on that scale initially, that might have affected how things kind of shook out later on. But one thing that was surprising in this study, and this also happened in our prior trial that was a shorter term study, is we saw bigger reductions in internalized stigma in the comparison group than we had predicted. So we had also kind of expected to have not as big of a drop in internalized stigma among the patients who didn't actually receive a stigma intervention. And I have a few thoughts on why we might have seen that. This wasn't actual standard care. This was done in a research context, and the interventionists all led both the comparison groups and the stigma intervention groups. And we did that because we didn't want there to be interventionist effects. So we didn't want to, inadvertently have a more effective interventionist or a more experienced interventionist in one group versus the other. But everyone involved in this study was highly trained in, stigma, talking about weight stigma. Of course, we did our best to make sure that even folks who weren't getting the stigma intervention were still getting compassionate, respectful care. We celebrated, successes in terms of behavioral changes. We tried not to focus the sessions so heavily on weight, even though, of course, we were measuring that for the study. So there were different elements of the environment that were supportive and respectful that may have kind of played a role. I think also the peer support was a really powerful piece, even when people weren't getting the kind of cognitive behavioral techniques, just having that group support probably helped to reduce people's internalization.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's great.
That's what I thought. Yeah, I figured that had to be the issue there.
I mean, do you think that, we and as many people as we can get should try to, incorporate, say, psychologists and group sessions, under this model? Do you think it's it's there yet. I mean, as you probably saw, one of our recommendations from that paper was to screen for and refer to you basically for this type of therapy. But I guess how in the real world do you suggest people like us might be able to accomplish that? Either, you know, so some clinicians aren't going to have the resources to refer out, so they're going to have to try to do this stuff on their own. I hope to have, develop a psychology aspect to this. And I think Spencer does, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the way that I would do it is I would screen, and then we would have specific lessons done, given electronically and support groups. But I think a trial needs to be done within our program, and we're probably going to work on this. And we're probably going to consult with you, Dr. Pearl.
But yeah, kind of some practical points for clinicians out there. Like, yeah, what should I do in my department? What could I do to make it?
Yeah. And I'll say, you know, as a scientist, I would say this is probably still preliminary, and I would love to do a bigger test of this, have a bigger sample to increase confidence. And again, because this is drawing from already evidence-based strategies, I do think there are some practical things that clinicians can do now. And even in terms of screening, instead of administering a long measure, you could also just ask patients, how does weight affect how you think and feel about yourself? And we've done some recent work actually testing that exact item and showing it correlates with these scales that might be a little more intuitive.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that, because despite this, these recommendations we put out and knowing about, learning about these screening tools, I have basically in reality been able to just kind of get it out of people when we do a weight history and we talk about it. They basically end up telling me, and we have these conversations, and I just kind of acknowledge it and try to understand it. And so, yeah, I feel like you don't necessarily need to get that specific, because if you ask them in the right way, they'll tell you, right?
Right. Yep. And I think, for people who don't volunteer it, having kind of a question about that as part of your standard interview is useful to, create a space for talking about how this affects people. And and I will also say, not everybody will have internalization to this degree, right? So there are many patients that it doesn't really affect how they view themselves. They just want to be able to run around with their grandkids and, that it's more the physical effects that bother them. So, we don't need to force this upon everybody, but it might not be relevant. But just a simple question of opening up a conversation about how does this affect how you think and feel yourself, feel about yourself, validating their experiences or encounters with stigma, being a listening ear, a supportive ear, that validation in and of itself might be more than most patients have ever gotten or ever gotten in a healthcare setting. I can say when screening participants for this study and asking them these kinds of questions, a lot of people said they've never really talked about this with anybody, that this is the first time anybody had asked them these kinds of questions. So I think that intervention in itself of just opening up a conversation and being really validating and supporting and supportive can be powerful. Even psychologists who, might not have a manualized intervention for internalized stigma, if they're educated about weight, and I think that's also part of it, is just educating more people about these kind of misconceptions about weight. You can, as a psychologist with any kind of background in these interventions, it's not that challenging to tailor it to weight. So I think there are some, practical things that people can be doing now, even, until the kind of clinical trials catch up.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for coming on and describing this. It's new for clinicians to even understand what this is, this internalized biases and stigma, and like, it's good that we're able to at least present your data and learn from you specifically from one of the experts out there. Any other project you're working on right now? I would love to. I mean, I'll probably message you, and because I think this needs to be studied. Even within like a pharmacological way, like how does the medicine maybe change this? I have no idea. But
And I think what we don't really know is if treating obesity specifically reduces internalized weight bias and stigma. And because a lot of times when we talk about staging the severity of disease, we talk about what things are going to get better with you know, quote unquote, weight loss as a surrogate, you know, because we don't care about weight necessarily. We care about what aspects of their health can we, are complications and can we improve upon? And so there was a little bit of debate about that when we put this together, like, well, we don't know if we can reduce that just by treating the obesity per se, but that's why I think what you're doing is just so, it's just so critically important for people's mental health and just overall well-being.
Yeah. And yeah, that is a really good question of how does, you know, how do obesity treatments, especially as they advance, affect stigma? As I mentioned, we weren't expecting internalized stigma to reduce so much in our studies because some of the prior work had shown that it really doesn't move much when people go through treatment. And I think there are also ethical considerations to keep in mind about what it actually means to recommend weight loss to someone who's struggling with body image or with internalized weight stigma, that we don't want to give a message that says, well, the solution is to change your body in order to change how you're treated or how you feel about yourself. Yeah. But that being said, I do think there's a place for this, for stigma reduction to go hand in hand with providing comprehensive evidence-based treatment.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Anybody listening to this who has a family member or friend that could benefit, please share it with them. Make sure you give us a review on whatever you're listening to Spotify, I don't know, Google, Apple, whatever, the big one, Apple. And thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Pearl. It's been great. And we'll probably have you on in the future again.
Yeah.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for bringing attention to this important topic.
You got it. Here's our outro, everyone.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.